All right, so first things first, can you tell us your name, your position at the ECCC, and a brief summary of what you were doing there?
My name is Philip Weiner. I worked for the Office of the Co-Investigating Judges, particularly the International Co-Investigating Judge. I served as chief of the legal division. Basically, I was chief of staff or chef de cabinet, basically chief of administration under the judge. I worked in two different fields. One, I handled the day-to-day administration for the co-investigating judge's office. And two, I was a lawyer slash investigator, handling legal work, interviewing witnesses, like any other legal officer. And also in addition to that, I oversaw one of the cases.
Great. And can you tell us a little bit about what brought you to the ECCC in this role?
I've been working in war crimes since 2001, mainly in Europe. I worked about 10 and a half years. And it's a small field, and you know each other in the field. And I was asked to apply. They wanted an experienced person to come in and serve in this role as chief of the legal division or chief of staff. And I applied and got the job, but it's what I had been doing for years.
Great. So let's talk a bit about the hybrid court aspect of the ECCC. What are your thoughts on the positives and the negatives of having a hybrid court?
When people say hybrid court, there's actually two different types of hybrid, or two different types of hybrid. One hybrid is where you have internationals and domestic judges, prosecutors, attorneys working in one location. The other view of hybrid is where you have a mixture of the civil and common law system. It's a hybrid, a mix. Here we have a double hybrid. We have internationals working in a country, on domestic cases, and we have a mixture of the civil and common law systems. It's mainly a civil or inquisitorial type legal system, but it still is a hybrid because it is a mixture. I like the hybrid legal system because it's the best of both worlds. You tailor the system to your own particular needs, and I really like the hybrid. I've recommended to other countries the hybrid system, especially developing nations, similar to Cambodia. The particular legal system, the way it was used and implemented here at the court, I do not like. I do not think it functioned well. It just, in my opinion, did not work fast enough. For example, I'll get a little technical. The civil legal system, you spend so much time investigating, and then you turn over the case file or the whole investigation. In a civil system trial court, you bring a few witnesses or a handful of witnesses, or could be more, to testify, and the rest of the case you introduce the case file. Here, what they did is they did a very long investigation, and then they did a very long trial, which was not how a civil system was planned. So the system just didn't work well, in my opinion. I didn't care for the way the system functioned. They also had problems because they didn't follow, if they were going to use a hybrid civil common law system at trial, then you have to do certain things such as interview witnesses before or have some idea what the witnesses are going to say. But here, you had witnesses interviewed 6 years earlier and no one had talked to them. In one case, they had a witness who no one had talked to in 15 years. They had no idea what he was going to say. I watched it on the video where the defense called this person to testify, thinking that he was going to be a key defense witness, and he turned it out into, or he became really a prosecution witness. He was a journalist who had previously written 15, 20, 20 plus years earlier that there was, that the Khmer Rouge was a very nice, kindly system. And then he realized over the years with everything he'd seen that it was, I think he described it as a genocidal system. And because of the way the system functions, when no one had talked to the witness, the defense wound up putting it on, and it didn't help their case at all.
That's really interesting. Thank you for giving us the example on that one. Can you talk a little bit about any significant challenges you faced in your role at the ECCC?
Let's see. Challenges. It's always challenging to investigate a very, very old case. We're interviewing people concerning incidents which occurred from 1975 to 1979, and even prior to 75, they'll give us background information. And it's hard. People have passed away. People have forgotten different incidents which occurred. So dealing with old cases are difficult. Another problem that we had on the administrative scene, or in my administrative function, was funding. Budgeting. One of the problems that we're dealing with today is the lack of funds. Donors are comfortable giving funds for a year or two, and even four, five, 6 years, and then they're really not interested in funding. There's donor fatigue. There are so many different tribunals that they want to fund. It becomes very difficult. And there were times that we needed more staff. For example, we had on the first case, case two, three or four times the number of investigators as we had for three other cases. The case four, the separate case four cases, and case three. We had three times the number of investigators. We had probably double the number of legal officers. But by that time, financial restraints cut down the number of staff, so it made it much more difficult. We were trying to do the same amount of work with less staff. So both administratively and case-wise or legally, there were difficulties.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the international and Cambodian sides that were working on this. So at various times, those two sides arrived at different positions. Can you comment on any formal or informal ways in which those different positions, perhaps cultures, were adjudicated?
I think, again, it goes back to the establishment of the court and the drafting of the rules. My view has been, when you bring in international staff, whether you've done this in Bosnia, whether you're doing this in Rwanda, ICTY, ICTR, any of the tribunals, Kosovo, what they did is they made a decision, since you're bringing in international staff, they should serve as the lead. They should serve as the role models. And I think if you had an international tribunal that had an international majority, you wouldn't have conflicting decisions. And I think that should have been done from the start. What happened in Kosovo, initially they did not have an international majority, and they had so many problems that they changed the statute and they established an international majority, and they told the internationals, you have to lead this court and get the cases moving and adjudicate the cases. And it worked. They did the same in Bosnia. When the Bosnian court, which was the busiest war crimes court in the world, the State Court of Bosnia, the war crimes section, when that started for the first 4 or 5 years, it was an international majority, and they told the internationals, lead and take this through. And I think they should have done the same here. And because they didn't, we've had so many conflicts, and it's not clear where the cases are going to go.
Yeah.
The investigations are going to go in the future. And that's why I think an international sitting as a majority on the courts would have made the difference.
Yeah. Kind of following up on that, are there any, you know, anecdotes that you might tell us about how, about the interplay between those two sides during the process?
Yeah. We used to see in the newspapers that there was all this hostility between the domestic or the national side and the international side. And in reality, everyone got along quite well. I just did, my counterpart was Bora Meese, who was chief of staff for Judge Huber Lang, and I just did a course. He teaches law school. I just did a course Sunday morning for him. And we've become good friends. The analyst, their analyst, Soria Sim, we're friends. We actually had very good relationships. We could sit, we could discuss. There may have been disagreements, and they'd explain their views, they'd explain their reasoning, we'd explain ours. But overall, it was a very friendly process. And I used to read in the newspaper, these people are ready to kill each other, the tension is terrible, and I don't know where they were talking about, because we got along pretty well. We'd have lunch together, and we attended each other's parties, and it was rather friendly.
Good. It's good to hear that, that it was a friendly place to be. How would you compare your experiences here at the ECCC with other courts that you've been involved in? You said you've done international work before.
Yeah. It was here was difficult because this is a donor court, and each year you're practically begging for funds. Where if you went to the ICTY, the Yugoslav Tribunal in The Hague, you got practically all the money you wanted. Whatever you needed, you got. In Bosnia, which was a donor court, you still got as much funding as you really needed. There was only one situation in my 4 and a third years there where we didn't get the funding for one particular project. One, possibly two situations. And the second, we did get the funding in the end. But I'll just give you a little anecdote. We had a small office in Bosnia. A small court. We had 8 courtrooms and we were busy, but the offices for staff, we'd have 2 judges per office, and prosecutors, I think they had 3 prosecutors per office. And we got a visiting delegation, diplomatic delegation, and they said, you have all these people that are practically sitting on top of each other. And they said, we've got to do something. And the next day, they donated enough to build 2 wings, 2 stories, or 3 stories, 60 offices, additional offices. And they said, how soon can you get this done? We'll give you the money immediately. And I think of that versus here, where you were practically begging for money to do anything. And the other tribunals, it was different. Maybe it was a different era where countries felt that they should be giving. On the other hand, there are so many more courts, there are more investigative mechanisms, that it is harder because countries are giving a lot. Financially, the countries around the world are not doing as well as they were in the early 2000s. So it's much more difficult here. And I think if any of these investigative tribunals actually go forward, such as this Myanmar mechanism, or the one in Syria or Iraq, they have to have some sort of guaranteed funding, that they don't have to try and develop a budget without worrying that no money is going to come in, or that they have to put 4 people per an office, that you have to walk around the desk just to get in and out.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely an interesting thing to think about looking forward. Looking forward a bit more, are there any other lessons learned or best practices or recommendations that you would have for future courts based on your time here?
Yeah, I don't like the system. I've told you, I don't care for the legal system. I would not use this type of legal system again. If they did, you'd have to change it. for example, proofing witnesses or talking, being able to talk to witnesses before they take the stand, having this long, long, long investigation period, and then retrying the cases all over again as if the investigation period never really existed. That just doesn't work. The donor court issue, I wouldn't do that again. Or if you have to do the donor court, you have to have guarantees financially. Also, I would have a situation, if you were going to bring international judges in, they would have to be in the majority. You can have a situation, in my view, without the internationals who are coming not being in the majority.
Okay. Any successes or victories that you either had in your personal work here at the ECCC or, you know, just in the courts in general?
I think the fact that we tried cases, I think the fact that we completed investigations, very complex investigations, that is a victory. Legally, we've made some new law in certain areas, such as torture-tainted evidence, forced marriage. Those are successes for the legal system. The area that I'm most proud of is something that the UN allowed me to do. The donors basically stated that we hope that the legal system in Cambodia takes some of the lessons from the court and it improves. And they have. They've taken the computerization ideas that the court uses, the ECCC uses, and they're starting to implement them in the appellate court. They have taken, or they're learning the ideas of legal reasoning from the common law system, and they're trying to implement those in the court. The area I'm most proud of is I was approached I think this late summer 2014, and asked to start training, would I participate in the training of judges, prosecutors, attorneys, and especially the national police. And I got Judge Karapkin involved when he came, and we have had over 1,000 police officers in our classes in the last 4 years. And I've had probably 20% of the judges in Cambodia as law students or students in classes, and we've tried to give them some of the latest ideas, introduce areas of law. Having spent all this time in the civil system, there are areas of law which just aren't covered, but are now existing in the Cambodian legal system. For example, the law of conspiracy is not used in the civil system. However, with the changes in Cambodia, you now can have conspiracy cases, but there's never been any classes on conspiracy. We provided the first classes. We provided the first classes on causation in criminal law, where if you have multiple accused committing acts, who's responsible? Which accused? We also are providing the first trainings in the area of rape investigation, interviewing sexual assault victims, interviewing domestic violence victims. And I think that's very, very important. And I'm very proud of that, the legal training that we've provided.
Oh, that's great. I'm sure that they very much appreciate having your input on that. On the flip side of that, are there any opportunities that perhaps could have been accomplished in the courts but weren't, either for legal reasons or because of other impediments?
Yes. Being on the investigative side, and Mr. Sempo sitting behind you, can also tell you that you try to get as much information as you can. And one of the sad situations was two countries that had a great deal of information, Thailand and Vietnam, did not contribute, did not participate. And they have, apparently, their own archives on Cambodia, on information they have, on information they seized when they came into the country in 1979, and they would never turn that over.
Hmm.
And they took, I believe, or I'm guessing they took the view that we have good relations with Cambodia now, we don't want to cause any problems. And as a investigator, as a prosecutor looking for all the information, or as a defense attorney looking for all the information to put on a defense, all three of us in these different areas and the judges want as much information that's out there. And when you can't get access to that information, it's frustrating. And it was really frustrating. And I know if trials occur, the defense will be frustrated, the prosecution will be frustrated, the judges, and all the way going back to us at the start, the investigators are frustrated.
Yeah, I can certainly understand how that would be frustrating. So maybe thinking about that and other maybe perhaps challenges that the courts face, what do you think significant challenges will be for future courts handling mass atrocities based on your work here?
I think the key is funding and getting the international community involved. They have been involved. I know there's the court, the Kosovo court, the new Kosovo tribunal in The Hague, and the EU is, and the United States is giving a lot of money. They're also funding three other new mechanisms to do investigations through the United Nations. That's the key. These are expensive. Tribunals are expensive. At first you wonder, why is a court so expensive? But when you're dealing with so many languages, that means you need interpreters and you need translators, and any document that's seized has to be translated, and you need prosecutors, and you need defense attorneys, and you need judges, and you need legal staff to work with the judges, and the technical staff, and the buildings, and courtrooms. These are very, very expensive situations, or very, very expensive projects, and finances, to me, is going to be the key. I had heard that, was it last year or the year before, 20% of the money promised to the International Criminal Court never came in. And if something like that happens each year, how do these courts function without proper funding? It means reduction in staffs, which then probably lengthens the process because you have less people. So funding, I think, is the key issue for the future.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like that is an important part of the process. For you personally, were there any experiences that you can recall that changed either your perspective or your opinion or practice at the ACCC?
Yeah, one thing, it's really, maybe it's a personal anecdote. When I came, people would tell me, or people who I would meet, that Cambodians don't want to talk about the Khmer Rouge period. It's going to be very difficult. I was warned with certain witnesses, this one might just cry the whole time. They'll give you a little bit of information and they'll cry. But I was surprised. People were really forthcoming. Some people, I think, really wanted to tell what happened. And to me, that was very similar to Bosnia with the Bosnians. Once you started them talking, it was like a flow of water. They wanted to tell everything. They wanted to tell how they suffered. And I found the same in Cambodia, which I was told the opposite. No one will talk to you. People won't want to tell you anything. And some of these people would say that they had never even told their families or children. This was the first time. And I just found it very interesting. I found the people to be very warm. Warm, friendly, even if it was hard to communicate without the translators, people were very warm and friendly, and sometimes they would say things that are very touching. One older man told me that he was very proud that his grandson was going to college. And he said, I want them to be smart like you lawyers. And it was really touching that he had this pride in his face that he was so proud his grandson was going to be probably the first from his family to go to university. And there was just a warmth. The people were very warm. I was told that many of the people after the Holocaust were very reluctant to speak, and there was almost a lot of bitterness with many of the witnesses. But I didn't find that here, and I didn't find that in Bosnia. Maybe a bit in Bosnia, but I didn't find it here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People, there was a warmth and an interest in what we were doing, and they wanted to tell their story.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've actually had the same experience. People before were like, you want to be careful talking about the Khmer Rouge, but I haven't been here as long as you have, but I've found the same thing since I've been here, that a lot of people do seem to want to tell their stories. On that, in that vein, and keeping within the boundaries of what's been released to the public, are there any either accused or survivor stories that you came across during your time at the ECCC that really resonated with you?
There are a lot of stories of suffering. And I think the fact that people were able to survive in such difficult, almost horrendous, or horrendous times, the ability to survive shows almost an inner strength. It was very, very impressive. When I've talked to witnesses in the Bosnian situation as a prosecutor or here as an investigator, or listened to witnesses as a judge sitting on war crimes cases, you know, sometimes I think when I go back to my office, how would I have handled that situation? Could I have survived? How would I have handled the beatings working out in the hot weather every day, forced to work? And you have to give a lot of these people credit. They had a will to survive, a will to live, and they were able to survive no matter how bad things got. They found ways to remain alive. And that's really impressive for people who have been beaten and removed from cities and placed almost in imprisonment type situations.
Yeah, I can't imagine what it must have been like. So thinking forward again, what do you think the major impacts of the ECCC will be on Cambodian society, both today and then maybe thinking about 20 years forward?
I think that the ECCC has had a very strong outreach program. Sometimes as many as 600 people visit the court a day. And I used to see the young people. Sometimes I'd go over and talk to them. And many of them didn't know anything about the Khmer Rouge. And it's so important that they learn. And if you don't learn about history, the old adage, history will repeat itself. And it's so important, and DCCAN has really done this and done this well, with outreach and letting people know what's happened. Also, I think that you develop history through war crimes cases, through testimony. People learn what happened. History is developed. And you're doing the same thing. And I think that's also important because people have to know what's happened. They use the term in war crimes cases, crimes against humanity. It's an area of crimes because these crimes aren't just against one particular group or two or three groups. When these massive crimes occur, it is a crime against the world. It's a crime against humanity. And that's what happened here. There were crimes against the world that were really committed because so many people were mistreated and punished and abused and murdered. that it affects the whole world, and that story has to get out. Everyone knows, or I don't know, things are changing. It used to be everyone knew about what happened in the Holocaust, what happened during World War II, but not as many people know what happened in Canada. I'm sorry, what happened in Cambodia, what happened in Bosnia, what's happened in other countries. And that's so important that people know the lessons of the past.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing all of this with us. Before we wrap up, is there anything we haven't talked about that you would like to say or that you think we should know?
No, I really enjoyed working here. Each court is different. Each conflict is different and fascinating from a legal point of view, dealing with different types of crimes, especially as the laws of war develop. And this was very different from the Bosnian conflict, which I've dealt with. This was very different from the Kosovo conflict. And each conflict is different. And not only do you work on the conflict as a lawyer or an investigator, but you also learn. You learn a piece of history. And this was a fascinating piece of history. And not just this, I learned a lot about Cambodian history and history of the area, Thailand and Vietnam. And I'll be honest, I really didn't know that much. I knew a bit about the Khmer Rouge and the Khmer Rouge situation, but just a small amount on the killing fields. But I had the ability to learn so much and so much about the area, to go to Angkor Wat up in Siem Reap and see the great temples, which was like visiting the pyramids, and see the whole history of the area. And when I was in Vietnam, visiting the Cham Museum and learning about the area, learning about the different cultures and how they melded together. And that was a really great experience. The other experience that I'm very proud of is the teaching, which goes back to the United States. I was a prosecutor and for 20 years. I was a visiting law professor in one of the law schools. And I very much enjoyed working on training programs. And in the mid-80s, I started training programs for narcotics officers because we were losing a number of cases involving search warrants. And I built off that. We just continued. Then from there, I started teaching prosecutors. And then I was probably the only attorney allowed to teach judges on search warrants in Massachusetts. And from there, it just moved on to working internationally. And when I came to a developing country such as Bosnia, you'd see the problems as a judge, you'd see problems in court. And I wanted to do something. So I started training programs. And we had program after program. And when I got here, I was approached and said, okay, I'll do the same. And I find that a great accomplishment, a personal accomplishment. And when I see some units such as the cybercrime or the anti-cybercrime unit really doing well, really building, I feel a sense of accomplishment. I helped in that. I helped with investigative training. And that to me is personally, as I said, one of my real feelings of accomplishment here.
That's great. That sounds like a really amazing experience. Well, thank you again for speaking with us. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for inviting me.